We hereby, as a committee, invite you to this. I mean, invite all parties that are. I don't think looking at those that are here today, that except the department that have not any appeal. But in case you have and we are not aware of the fact that you have, we want to alert you. We want you to alert us to any issues which you feel may be subject to judicial decision. We do not wish for this public hearing to be ineffective, but we also do not wish to intrude on the arena of the Competition Appeal Court. The purpose of this public hearing is to scrutinize the Walmart Magma deal, not to prescribe to the competition authorities as to what conditions should be imposed on the measure. If the appeal is not upheld, but rather to get first-hand input on the impact of measures on employment, industrial development, local manufacturing and economic development. This is what we want to focus on, and we would request those who will be making presentations to respect to them. I'm going to repeat that again. Please respect what the committee says here. We will try by all means to ensure that we bring you back on track if we feel you are really not adhering to what you have said. And we request you to respect that fact. As and when we come back, we caution you, please respect the fact that we will we don't want to you to turn the hearing as also the judge for what will be happening during the actual court. I hope it is clear for those who are presenting today. Can I then give a record to deal with the apology?
Chairperson, the following members forwarded their apologies. Honorable Mother Mayor Ray Kawabata, who is on an oversight with the Portfolio Committee on Trade and Industry. Honorable Singh, who is currently abroad. Mr. Ngonyama, who is going abroad today. And Dr. Ravi, who is undergoing medical procedures. And that is it.
I'm happy that today you represent Dr. Karadi well. Thank you. Can I then, for the benefit of those who are presenting today, which is members of the committee, I'll start with Mr. Buinamo at the back there. Mr. Buinamo is a member of the Labour Portfolio Committee within the cluster of economic development in Parliament. We have Mr. Marae, who is a member of the Portfolio Committee Economic Development. Next to him is Member Stacey, the member of the Economic Development Portfolio Committee. Behind her is Mr. Nkuzi, who is also the whip of the Committee of Economic Development. Next to him, we have Mr. Mabasa, who is a member of the Portfolio Committee on Economic Development. Mr. Mabasa, Mr. Dosis, and the whip are also members of the Management Portfolio Committee. Thank you very much. I take it now that we have read the statement before you on behalf of the committee, we can now, and everybody understands the do's and don'ts, we can now commence with our hearing. So we have empowerment South Africa today. South Africa, not Southern Africa. Okay. And that will be presented by, the input will be presented by Ms. Nkosi. Over to you, Ms. Nkosi.
Thank you. Welcome every day for local across South Africa. Thank you. I also want to say thank you on behalf of Wokaman Z Abochamasjaki. I'd like to greet you in the name of the Almighty, He who is the beginning and the end. The Alpha, the Omega. My name is Mkuchi Mkuchi. I'm here as chairman of Empowerment of Faith. And you will have to bear with me, Madam Chair, if it happens that some of the rules that you stipulated sometimes in the law overlap, slightly because these things have been prepared in advance. So I'd have to bear with us.
We will call you to order the session when you feel you are overstepping.
Amen. In terms of who we are as Empowerment of Faith, we are a linkage company. Linkage is a company that facilitates relationships between white companies seeking to be as investors and vice versa, be investors looking for funders. We've also been known to publish procurement opportunities for both the private sector and the government. In terms of our access to suppliers, given that this transaction to some extent does talk about suppliers, we've got access to over 1,000 creditworthy suppliers, and we've published over 15,000 tenders. We've been approached by over 20 companies looking for BE partners, and we've also been fortunate in terms of affording some people using finance. These are some of our recent successes. As far as the hospitality, women empowerment, one of the highlights is we're doing a billion rand solar plant in Kimberley with the military veterans of South Africa. And we pride ourselves on the fact that everything that we do, we've already maintained in our belief in the broad-based black empowerment. We are in support of the presentation that was done by Walton 25, and I think we also need to commend the position that has been assumed by the FME Forum, led by Mr. Debo Kokas. And it therefore, you know, becomes very strange and sad to see that during this presentation I've been here for the past little while, and I realize that the union has been very vocal in terms of these deliberations, but there has been no black business. I thought I should bring that to your attention, Madam Chair, because it is very clear that it's always, once the deal is done, once everything has been cemented, that you're going to find black business voicing their displeasure. I'm proud to say that we have a hard-working president. If you look at the first 7 months of 2010, these are the trips that President Zuma has undertaken from Angola to China, Canada, Uganda, etc., etc. Now, there are those countries that I've highlighted in red, and those are the companies or the countries that are known to be aggressive and dangerous exporters. But the long and short of it, Madam Chair, in the House, is that we have to bear the fact and the consequence of being part of a global economy. One of the challenges posed by President Zuma's travel, the so-called unintended consequences, if we were to look at China, for instance, South Africa imports more from China than any other country. African countries. The total trade between the two countries is stands at 119 billion rand in 2009. When you look at the products that are being imported as well as exported, South Africa imports Chinese products, largely finished products, which is electrical machinery, electronic equipment, appliances, computers, etc., etc. But when you look at what we export to China, we export, raw materials. And the question then becomes, to what extent are we benefiting from the beneficiation of those products? I think everyone is in agreement that SMEs are job creators. Not only has it been established that that is the case in South Africa, but globally. And SMEs have been known to, in South Africa, between 1985 and 2005, 90% of all new jobs were created by SMEs, according to Finco. Brazil, last year revealed that between 1995 and the year 2019, 6% of new jobs were created by small companies. And according to the FEMA Trust, SMEs will create 2.5 million jobs in South Africa by year 2020. Added to this, FEMA believes the government could take about 500,000 people off the social grant scheme if we supported small business. Given that this presentation pertains to mass, given the fact that I think a bulk of the presentation that has happened so far, there's been a huge outcry about the possible impact on SMEs in the townships like these products. Now, unfortunately, I come from the retail background. My father, in fact, my great grandfather was close to President Mandela, was in the retail space in Cleveland. My father was in the retail space. So when I speak of the retail sector, I'm speaking about something that runs in my blood. It is not something that I read from the papers. And the reality is that there's a great deal of challenge faced by a lot of country businesses. Sorry. The first challenge is the fact that there has been a great deal of emphasis and focus and concentration on the retail space, meaning we have traditionally bought finished products and sold a finished product without paying any value. Since the 90s, we've seen a great deal of proliferation of shopping malls, as well as the opening up of suburbs by Somalis, as well as people from Pakistan. The unfortunate fact is that the shopping malls that have been opened in the township, a lot of them, they are anchored by JSE listed companies. One of the cornerstones of puzzle, which is Metro Cash and Carry, commonly known as Metcash, is now in direct competition with the same puzzle because they have closed, or they're closing 51 stores in order to open what is called hybrid retail stores. Now these are big stores which are identical to the Walmart model. Cambridge, which is a mass subsidiary, has been quoted as saying that they are going to be very, very strong as far as loss leader model. Now, loss leader is when people sell a product at a loss in order to gain market share. And that on its own is going to mean that a lot of companies are going to, a lot of thousands in the townships are going to come across a lot of competition. ShopRite has opened a lot of so-called franchises in the township. I say so-called because they're not, the most eco-friendly, so that one finds the township, but the reality is that we are finding the bed. Because we're finding a lot of stores where people just dump boxes in a warehouse in the township and then they call it a store. And that's the reality that township retailers are having to contend with. And then naturally, increasing hunger and fascination by a big retailer towards cheap imports. So finally, that in instances where you find Kenneth biscuits, which may be sold for 10 rand a packet, they are having to compete with cheap imports that are being sold either at Pick n Pay or Checkers or ShopRite at half a price. That's the reality that we have to contend with. Now, I know that the unions have been very vocal on the impact of bringing Walmart into South Africa. I'd like to believe that this deal is as good as done, but one of the certain parts is the emphasis and the concern about job losses. Now, one of the things that is going to happen, Madam Chair, is that in South Africa, everyone that is with a cell phone will soon have a shop in their cell phone, meaning we'll have an MTN opening up what will be known as multi-shop, whereby everyone who's got a cell phone will be able to do purchases using their cell phone. And that is going to mean that every other shop that sells the same product will have to compete with MTN. And that, I think, is a bigger threat, because there is no jobs whatsoever that are going to be created. There's going to be no value whatsoever that is going to be created by any company, black, white, big and small. All that is going to happen is that you're going to find big wholesalers that are going to supply directly to people, which is the same model which has been adopted by Pick n Pay. Pick n Pay have got an online ordering system where they deliver to households directly. Now that means that whatever we are talking about as far as Walmart is concerned, it's an extension of what is already happening within South Africa. These are the challenges that are being faced by retailers in the country. Now, the problem that we as an arbitrary have with the current mass model of business is that I think even recently we've heard that they are going to be acquiring food spots, and that on its own means that they may achieve their BEE target. Their enterprise development targets, their growth strategy through acquisition. It's good for the bottom line, but it is not in line with broad-based empowerment. And that's why we believe that if much were to adopt a broad-based path of growth, will be a lot more involved in in its growth. In terms of Walmart has got a lot of international suppliers, including the farming sector, that it already has a relationship with. And our fear and concern is that a lot of those suppliers are going to flex their muscles within South Africa, and that is going to pose a problem to local manufacturing. And as I've mentioned, the loss leader undercutting model by Cambridge is a concern to us as empowerment there. And then, as I said, there's also the issue of cheap imports. But one of the biggest problems, naturally, when Muscat goes into the food space, is that a lot of the products that you and I have traditionally called our food, meaning, mkhodu, things like Maguinia, I come from, so yeah, those are products that we have traditionally, I mean, even traditional beer, we had traditional beer not so long ago, which was bought off the shelf. Now, what it tells you is that a lot of the products that we have called our own or our mother's creation are increasingly being adopted by a big retailer. And that on its own means that there is unintended consequences in terms of the proliferation of these stores within the township. Again, the backdrop of the point that I stated in page 9, namely the challenges that have been that are being faced by a lot of retailers, big and small, black and white. We as a community believe that it would help a lot of manufacturers, black manufacturers especially, if we were to support the establishment of a supply fund by Massmart and Walmart. And what I'm going to do is just go through the impact of the fund that we are talking about. There's been, I think there's been a hand of friendship that has been extended by Walmart, Massmart, in terms of them opting to give R100 million.
On this one, can I buy a real from continuing?
All right.
Yeah. Because it forms part of the process of the constitution that is put by the tribunal, and they are part of it. And the action.
Okay. I will have to find a way of navigating through the presentation without step on toes, but...
Take your time to look at that.
Yes.
You don't mind, because you have prepared already the plan.
All right. Now, when one goes through the presentation that has been made by a lot of the unions, a lot of the unions speak of job losses as a result of Walmart coming into the country. The unfortunate reality, Madam Chair, is that as you and I speak now, South Africa is growing at a relatively slow pace, largely because a bulk of the big companies are not mature South African citizens, corporate citizens. Now, what do I mean by this? If you look at the fact that there are companies that are refusing to adhere to broad-based black economic empowerment. There are companies that are refusing to adhere to employment equity stipulation. There are companies that would rather pay fines instead of employing black executives. It shows that a lot of the big companies which are big employers are not patriotic corporate citizens. And as a result, if we talk of job reservations or the maintaining of jobs within those companies, we are shooting ourselves in the foot. Because it means that we are allowing those same companies to retain their market dominance. I need to bring to the attention of the House that not so long ago, I think it was early this year, if not last year, we learned that there are construction companies that robbed this country of billions of rand when they were constructing failure for 2010. And we are talking about big companies that are well respected, that are job creators. Now the question then becomes, are we supposed to be aligned to big unpatriotic companies because they are creating jobs, or should we embrace new companies that are open to us being able to engage with them on creation of funds for enterprise development? As a Power Minister, we would like to offer the second option, because we believe that for a very long time, as I said, we are fortunate in that we get approached by a lot of companies that are seeking BEEs. When we say they need to comply, they do just for the sake of ticking a box. And we are therefore saying, if it means that we have got to shed some jobs in South Africa, but by bringing new players who are open to broad-based black economic empowerment, so be it. And therefore, it becomes important that everything that we do, we've got to bear in mind that a lot of the companies that are within South Africa, a lot of them they are losing this economy. And as a result, we as a parliament, we are recorded saying that we will do everything in our power to bring a lot of foreign companies into South Africa, and that's why we welcome the coming into South Africa by Walmart. And naturally, when Walmart comes into South Africa, we'd like to believe that they would need to hold hands with people that can are known to have the interest of the country at heart. When you consider that on page 13, we said that Minister Sofane has received about 1.1 billion rand for the construction of houses. South Africa has got a backlog of 1.2 million houses. Now what it means is that we need to find ways and partners that are going to make sure that all of this is not resting on the shoulders of government, meaning that we have got to use existing partners like Maslow. Let us use their builder's warehouse in order to be able to start creating jobs for unemployed youth by making sure that through their builder's warehouse, we are able to achieve the goals that have been, the goals that have been set for Minister Sofane. If you look at page 13.5, 972 million has been set aside to build 6,000 affordable rental units. That is not a lot of money, Madam Chair. And therefore, we believe that we would like to recommend that MASMAS through their builder's warehouse be sensitive to a private-public partnership with the likes of the minister and department, so that we can start creating jobs through provision of housing. And at the same time, in the course of us being able to address the problems that have been cited in page 7, we still maintain that everything that we do, it needs to go hand in hand with existing players. And as a result, to welcome any way in which MASMAS can embrace enterprise development through franchise model. A franchise model which is going to make sure that when they grow their branches, their Cambridge branches to the township, they do it in a franchise model in partnership with people. And the organizations that we believe can hold hands with not only Empowerment Estate, but also the MASMAS, the Walmart of this world. They range from the Free State Development Corporation, LISA, the SME Forum, Business Place, NAPCOM, Shanduba, etc., etc. But the long and short of it, Madam Chair, is that we work closely with people like the Free State Development Corporation, as well as the Ministry of Economic Affairs in the Free State Congress in Policy, in order to make sure that we start identifying manufacturers in outlying areas in the rural areas, because there's been a migration or brain drain from those areas. Therefore, I would urge this House to be sensitive to ways in which the parties that are mentioned can start incorporating manufacturing in outlying areas like the Free State, the Kwakwas of this one. And naturally, everything that we do, it needs to be in line and not parallel to what the President has done so far in terms of making sure that we start creating partners, trade partners with the countries that the President has been to. And as a result, we urge the House to be sensitive to all the steps that have been taken by President. So whatever deliberations happen within the measures, they need to take into account that we as South African companies, we need to start being export-oriented as opposed to always focusing on the local market. And if it means that we've got a big brother in the form of Walmart that is coming into the country to partner with South African companies so that their growth into the African continent It is in partnership with South African exporters who welcome something like that. Now, in conclusion, I think everything that I've said, it boils down to the fact that the reality within the township is that all the major supermarkets, as we speak right now, have been insensitive to the price of the spada, ranging, as I said, from the net cash of this world to the pick and pay of this world to the shop price. And as a result, it shouldn't come as a surprise when we hear that Walmart is going to open in the township, because it's nothing new, it has happened before. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Kutsi. I guess the committee has you, and I'm going to give them an opportunity then to ask you questions of clarity and make comments for a second. I've noticed that Dr. Winamo, Mr. Mare, Babu Mabasa, and that's all.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Dr. Mkuti, for that brief and very clear presentation. You have alluded to the fact that South Africa imports from China than any other African country. Now, my question is, to what extent is China importing from South Africa? And if you can give us estimates in rent, and that this as significant then to the South African economy. Question number two, how do Somalis and Pakistanians trading in African townships and villages obtain trading rights? If they have. I'm asking this because if you go into rural villages, there are shops that used to be owned by Africans. Now they are almost all of them owned by Pakistanis and Somalis. And the question we ask is, it appears it's easy for them to obtain licenses when it's difficult for local people who want to enter into businesses to obtain trade rights. And the other thing is, are they monitored to check as to whether they observe health rules? I'm asking this also because they sleep and bath in those shops. Number three, you also alluded to the fact that the traditional African beer, mkhodu, mrogo, etc., has been now adopted by Woolworths. The question is, rather my input to what you said, that it's now recently been adopted by let's say white traders. My experience is they've long been adopted by by white traders, because for many years we've been buying African beer, you know, from the shelf, and at Mala, some shops sell mkhodu in tins, you know. And now, what do you think? Do you think we should, as Africans now, reclaim these from white traders? I don't know if that's your position, and if it's your position, how do you think it can be done, given that there's no copyright on those things?
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you very much for the presentation. I really want to congratulate you with this presentation. I think you've touched on quite a lot of points of concern that I think everybody shares with you and cannot criticize you on. But you also have not only been critical, you've also come up with constructive suggestions. So that is positive. That is sometimes the difference between someone who sees a glass as half full or who is half empty. Now, clearly you see it as half full. Well done. I think if we have more people of your vision, you know, there will be more opportunities in South Africa. So well done on that. Just to link on to my colleague, and I don't want to, you know, to ponder on Somalis and Pakistanis, but if it is that they are taking over all the spaza shops, why do they survive? Or how can they survive if Africans cannot survive there? That's the first one. Then secondly, I mean, your comment on BBB, I think it's quite valid, and I think even this committee has identified that the current BBB objectives are not reached, are not achieved. Is there any suggestions from your side on the current BBB legislation and requirements, how that should be changed to really make it broad-based? Because we know we're not talking about broad-based economic empowerment. We're talking about BBB because it's not broad-based. We refrain from that word broad-based. So how can that be done in your view? Then, what you have said about support to new companies and how new companies, South African companies in South Africa, can add to job creation and economic growth. I think you've touched on one or two issues, partnerships, etc. But in your view, what should government be doing in supporting or making it easier for new South African companies to be competitive, to be globally competitive, to import, sell, to locally produce, to locally procure, to export, to be globally competitive? Is it tax incentives that you're talking about? Is it personal tax incentives? Is it subsidies that you're talking about? You know, is there any suggestions on that side? And then lastly, just you have referred to the countries that South Africa is doing business with, and specifically China. And I know the one question was, which is rather negative, but there's the number on the exports to China, but we know it's predominantly raw material. Now, do you have a view on what has been reported in the paper about the 45% acquisition of Wisinsu Platinum by Jinxing of China, where it was reported that they're going to move the local verification of that platinum to China? In other words, more jobs lost. Have you got a view on that, please? Thank you.
Can I, I'm not used to taking so many questions at a time. Do you mind if I answer these two and then take others before I forget? You know?
No. Just let you know, if you can, note them down and then you can be able to respond, because we are avoiding the follow-up to come and do it. Not everything, original question can be done. Can you give me a little answer?
Thank you, Comrade Chair. Thanks for the input, Chair from Patimbuji. My question is, if there's a big monopoly company that operates worldwide and it is dream is to swallow the small businesses so that it can be the only bull in the country. And once the small companies are swallowed up, the trick it uses is to lower prices as it gets into a country, and then the company dies. As soon as they have died, it then raises the prices again, so that it's now operating purely as a monopoly with no competition. Would you say, for us as South Africa, such a practice we should invite, or should we bar such a practice, seeing that we are a developing country? And then the second one is there are ways that you have used to say, because it is nothing new, it has happened before. You know, talking of the companies that go into townships, rural areas, because it is nothing new, it has happened before. I got the impression that you say we must then support, you know, support the practice. So just following on coaching you there, shouldn't we say, because it is nothing new, it has happened before, but if that implies it has caused us harm, shouldn't you say we should have a new way of doing this? But here, I'm just following on your quotation so that we can expand on it. And where a monopoly company operates, it usually works on the basis of casual labor, usually works on the basis casual labor and denying the workers the rights like UIF, medical aid, etc. Isn't such a company adding onto the misery of a country like ours, where we will have more people falling through the net and then going into the grant system of the country and burdening the social grant system of the country? And then the last one is don't we think that what is better is if we protect the jobs that are in existence now, instead of creating, let me assume, a 500 jobs while we kill 1,500 jobs, just in a ratio form. Thanks, Commissioner.
Thank you,
my question would be like, as you know what Honorable Mabasa was asking, I want to check for that. I can be clear. Are you comparing the method of operating of the Walmart in China or those countries which have put right now? If you compare them, are you saying, because we have dealt with this country, so why should we not deal with it with all my? How are you trying to put it out? And I want to find out about the development of the SME. Are you saying because the SME are not doing well because of this country? So let's add a one to add on what is written for the in fact, are you saying that add petrol to the fire? I mean, on the fire, I think that's what you are saying.
Thanks for having me. I just want to ask a question too, in relation to the sentence around challenges, the last bullet on your challenges with the model on mathematics. The retailers selling our traditional foods, and you did elaborate a bit on this. I think this is related to the earlier question that was asked by the city manager on having our staple food, for instance, in the shell processing company. What I want to know is, what is your real take on this? Because I was trying to understand your linkage to this. What is it that the CRS tried to say? Is it a good or is it a bad thing in your understanding or in the way you see things unfolding? And is it not because we or the very same part of the shops or the people who produce this type of paper food are selling them cheaply? I don't think it's now the problem of acceptance or understanding. It's about business, people understanding where you make more money from. And then adopting them and then being able to modify and then sell them, you know. Modify them through packaging or whatever and then being able to sell them. What should a normal or an ordinary shop or business in a location or in a village, what would you suggest as empowerment in South Africa for those kind of businesses to do in order to be able to attract, you know, people or consumers the way those big companies attract them, so that they don't, instead of seeing those the companies selling cheaply whatever that they have to bigger companies, they retain and then, you know, keep business within the localities. I don't know whether the question is clear or is complicated, but the intention is just to understand what you are saying and your suggestion and review around what actually can be done at the local level to improve rather than to sell whatever idea you have to other people who already have money.
Thank you for the questions. You'll bear with me if I forget some of your questions, but I'll start with yours, Madam Chair. I have dealt with a number of retailers, the big retailers, not only in the food and what you commonly refer to as a fast-moving consumer goods, but also on the clothing side. And when I compare the dealings that, or the responses that I've gotten from them when it comes to enterprise development, the successful model that has been adopted by the deployment of youngsters to these stores for them to sell, sausages and so forth, they've come out more popular and more successful. And by that I mean, as soon as big retailers that sell clothes, as soon as big retailers that sell food are able to give shopping space in terms of SMEs to open franchises within their stores, as soon as that happens, that is effective enterprise development as well as job creation. Now, in terms of the staple foods, the chakalas of this world, the morocos of this world, the most important thing that can happen is for the SME manufacturers to get shelf space. Now, what it means is that for a long time, we've had very good products. I come from Soweto and we had a gentleman called Fernando Cabela. He ran a beautiful salon called Dr. Finger Teeth, and he became very ambitious and he wanted to supply one of the big supermarkets. The cost of complying with supplying that supermarket actually put him out of business. Now, if you are saying that Massmart is going to adopt a black supplier in a way that is going to be friendly to their pocket, meaning it does not cost them as much as it costs a big retailer to put their products in the shelf. What are you going to do? It offers a lot of our own food to find ways into those shelves. Now, from what I've gathered, you have to bear with me, I'm not an expert on any of these retailers in terms of their numbers, etc., etc. But what I know is, if I am able to supply Metro with furniture, it is going to put me in a much bigger a production capacity than if I were to set up my own shop and try and sell on my own. So, in answer to the question, I'm saying there are a lot of good products that are manufactured by our mother. And one of the biggest stumbling blocks has is access to market. So, if you have a Massmart opening up its shelf, you know, in favor of a term to our mother, it will then give our mothers a much bigger capacity to supply the nation through a bigger network than if they sell on their own. I hope that answers your question. Coming back to Mr. Ndule, we are part of the global community. We do business with everyone, and you've got to bear one thing in mind, you know, our president is a God-fearing president. He's attended church services with him. When we pray, God answers our prayers. And when we say we as South Africa want to be a global place, those things are manifesting as we speak right now. Meaning, when we said South Africa wants to be the strongest and the most effective economic player within the continent, it was not just a pipeline, it is happening right now. But in the course of that happening, it means that we have got no option but to be innovative in terms of how we engage with those economies. Let's look at a global player without naming anyone. If you have the biggest wholesaler coming into South Africa, as opposed to us viewing that global player as a supplier to South Africa, we must consider that global player as a customer to South Africa. We right now are exporting the Mercedes Benzes, both right hand drive as well as left hand drive, because we have embraced the Mercedes Benz as a partner to this country. When you look at what we have done in terms of manufacturing within the clothing industry, we tend to believe that we have got to buy. And I am saying, let us arrive at a stage where there's a mindset shift that says we need to start looking at all these big players buying from us. I know that Standard Bank has been acquired by a Chinese bank. I know that AXA has been acquired by Barclays. Are we ahead of any opportunities that have been presented by South Africans in terms of us being able to export our expertise to those countries? What I would have wished to see happen is a situation whereby AXA, or let's say Standard Bank, would be able to take our cell phone technology or cell phone banking, take it to China, so that we start creating SIM cards here in South Africa for the Chinese market. And that on its own is going to create a lot of jobs. So in answer to your question, I'm saying that there's got to be a mindset shift if we say we want to be a leader within the African nation. Secondly, when we talk of Okay, I've forgotten the second. The second, you spoke of petrol to fire.
I was saying that you mentioned the SMME. In fact, this question is if this is going to say, do you think SMEs are going to prosper if we've got these new nuclear bombs at the moment? Because I was saying that in our knowledge, there is some difficulty in the SME to prosper. So my question was like that is, do you think by coming of the Walmart is going to empower the MMA then for all, is going to continue to deteriorate their
health? Thank you, Mr. Mkuli. Yes, I cannot say blindly that there is not going to be any losses that are going to be witnessed as a result of, you know, huge import through the procurement process and systems from Walmart. But the reality is that I am saying we as small businesses will need to be innovative in terms of identifying opportunities within the country that State President Zuma has visited. And if it means that we have got to engage with Walmart, let's engage with the likes of Walmart as a client, not as people that are going to that are going to import into South Africa. Now, when you look at all those countries that I've stipulated, a lot of them, they are notorious and vicious exporters, but they have a soft spot for South Africa because they know the expertise that is in here. And that on its own offers a lot of opportunities for a lot of FSE to start tapping into certain basic issues that can be that can be exported to their country. So all I'm saying, yes, there will be instances where there are imports that are going to create unnecessary job sharing, but there are opportunities that we can use. I think there was a presentation yesterday which said that there are instances where Walmart has come into the country. It has helped a number of suppliers to become international suppliers. And I'm saying we need to be very pragmatic in our approach to the likes of Walmart in terms of saying, let us see to what extent we can become suppliers to Walmart and subsequently Massmart. If it means we have to supply at a coming back to I hope that answers your question. And then to Mr. Mabasa, should we bar monopolies from South Africa? No, we cannot bar monopolies from South Africa. It comes back to my previous answer, which is to say, we are meant to be the springboard into the continent. And as a result, our mindset has got to shift. And our mindset shift will result in us viewing a lot of those monopolies as potential clients as well. And yes, there will be instances where there are companies that do not have basic benefits like pension. I think, like I said when I started, I'm very impressed with the union in South Africa. They gave me an assurance that our mothers and fathers, they are in good hands because the unions have been very vocal about protecting their interests. In terms of should we protect jobs of companies that employ 1,500 instead of, I said, if you are finding yesterday, there are companies that are employing 1,500 people, but they are not patriotic, they are not good corporate citizens. Then,
can I come in there? You were talking about
In favor of, yes, correct. And my answer is, if you are having a company that employs 1,500 and is not patriotic, that is not a corporate citizen that we need in this country. We need companies that are going to understand that we've got an unemployment program right now. The companies that do not want to use the skills development facility simply because it doesn't care, they'd rather pay the fine. So all I'm saying is, we need a mindset shift. The youngsters that are out there, they are very reckless and they can do anything and everything if there's no certain things in terms of job. In terms of Mr. Marais, why do Pakistanis and Somalis survive? It's also the focus on imports. They've got the products that they bring into the country. That a lot of them are known to be dumped in South Africa, and they sell those products through their retail network. And I think it's Mr. Guzamo who spoke of the unhygienic way in which they or condition in which they operate, which is true. A lot of them, they do not care about the conditions in which they sell. They concern themselves in undercutting and selling the imported products as much as possible. And naturally, that is a very effect on our retailers in the township. And how can we help South African companies? Well, I think my previous answer is hopefully been able to put here. In terms of the Wasizwe deal, you see, that's the difference between the, should I call it the Chinese model and the American model. The company that is coming to South Africa is coming into Walmart, into Massmart. It is coming into an existing South African company and is going to grow into Africa through Massmart. Now, the Wasizwe transaction is talking of a South African operation that is going to be taken outside of South Africa for the benefit. In essence, they are just looking for their mining licenses so that they can extract all their resources from South Africa as possible. But in terms of beneficiation, we benefit nothing. And as a result, it just goes to show that the models are not the same. I would rather we have a company that is going to partner with South Africans and grow into the continent with South Africans as opposed to against South Africans. I think the BEE is so far, I think a lot has been covered. I'd like to believe that the success is that has been made so far in terms of its amendment. We're not seeing tangible results yet, but I think we're on the right track. Mr. Guzamo,
I have not heard you answering my question.
Are you covered? Oh, the licenses. Like I said, I mean, I come from a retail background, so even my family has been approached by, other nations wanting to use our premises. And the reality is that they come with generous offers in terms of what they want to pay for the, for the building as well as the trading license. And it becomes a lot easier for them. Come into an existing business and just use it. But as to how they get their licenses, I'd like to believe that there are channels that they follow, because in Soweto they are very stringent in terms of compliance with licenses. But I know a number of instances where you find that they prefer to buy an existing trading license. Meaning you are the black shop owner, you're going to get your rental of 10,000 rand, but in the process you are letting in a lot of imports that are going to kill other retailers in the township.
Thank you very much.
I also wanted to know how does the Chinese, the Chinese import to South Africa, how do they add value to South African economy? You'll bear with me if I keep referring to Joburg because that's where I'm from. The model that the Chinese have used in Joburg is that they have used their trade export incentives from their country to set up a lot of malls within Joburg. You've got places like Highgate Infant, where Makhlambesi used to operate there. I think it was one of the first Makhlambesi when he was building Makhlambesi. He operated from Kalman. And that place has become a Chinese, a China mall. And what it means is that they use export incentive from their country to set up shops in South Africa. They use employment incentive for them to be able to employ Chinese employees in South Africa. There's a lot of incentive from China for them to come into the continent. And as a result, that is why you find that a lot of the salaries of the Chinese are not paid by the businesses, but they're paid by the Chinese government itself to subsidize.
Have one
question.
Okay.
So the question that the chair tries to clarify, which was my question, was if we have a big monopoly company coming into South Africa and it promises to create, I'm just making an example, 5,000 jobs. But in the process of creating 5,000 jobs, the country loses 15,000 existing jobs. Would you say we should still welcome such a company on the basis of its promises?
I thought you answered that. You said no to that type of the company. Yes, that's what I had. Thank you very much. The same question, for the woman of Hale, Kaho Kamatapa, Austin Lona, or also Wikipedia, or a subsidization in your home, or the Villa Hoof.
Amen. God bless you.
You too. I never got the system. We'll now continue with the next presenter. To the next presenter, who is Mr. Ileshko. Is this Ileshko? Can you come, sir?
You will come forward, okay? Focusing around the merger, I only found out this morning,
that I wasn't supposed to do that, but the presentation is like this article is very directed to Mahatma Bodhma, because the underlying concept remains sound. If any company puts up a supply development fund of 100 million rand, it looks like a very large sum of money, but given the needs of the country, it's actually not very much unless one finds a way to multiply this money in a sustainable manner. And this can be achieved through franchising. And I was very pleased to hear this morning that franchising was mentioned several times. There seem to be a few misunderstandings about the concept, but nothing that comes with it. Franchising in South Africa is very well established. We have more than 500 franchisor companies. The big problem with franchising is that on the lower end of the range, very few, if any, opportunities exist. Most of the franchise stores who are members of the franchise association, which is sort of my special baby, I'm a large member of the association, I was a founder member some 30 years ago, are in an investment level starting on at the lowest end, 500,000 rand going up to 10, 12 million rand. This is not affordable to anyone, to everyone. And what the country needs, in my opinion, being a guest, I can only express an opinion, is low cost opportunities that are sustainable. And could I get a control for this slide? So, how does this. So how do I get the next slide? I'm sorry. Oh, yes. Here we are.
Thank you. I apologize.
What I'm trying to do with my presentation is to demonstrate that by allocating a fairly small portion of a fund like a 100 million supplier development fund to franchising, one could set in motion the development of a franchise network that will not only create self-employment, it will also create employment opportunities, and it will also impact on various other social problems the country faces. I think it would be fair to start off with a very small, with a very brief definition of franchising as a concept. It will help with the rest of my presentation. Basically, a franchise involves a franchisor and a franchisee. Franchising originated in the United States, and it was originally what we now define on hindsight a product franchise, whereby a factory, and the first franchisor historically was Singer, the sewing machine company, would grant the dealer the right to sell its machines on conditions that instruct the machines, demonstrate the machines, and support, in other words, repair the machine if it should break down. This has evolved over the years into a thing called business format franchise, which means a complete concept where the franchisor not only offers a product and a trademark, but also offers a complete business concept, in other words, how to run the business cost effectively and hopefully profitably. And on the other end of the scale, the franchisor, because its trademark is at risk, insists on controlling the quality of business performance. Much more recently, and I think this only goes back about 4 or 5 years, another variant of franchising popped up, and this is micro franchise. And my concern I expressed earlier that we don't have any low cost franchises in South Africa brings into this a micro franchise is not
Kaitani for that child, in its initial sort of interpretation, is supposed to be a comprehensive business format franchise concept, but of course adapted to the scale and the needs of a very small business. And I've been fortunate in being involved in two expo projects, one in Kenya and one in Botswana, where foreign aid organizations assisted government to set up micro franchise operations. And in both instances, these operations were aimed at bringing electricity, bringing light to people who couldn't afford grid connection. Or in the case of Botswana, it was all the people who lived in the remote villages were bringing power lines for 40, 50 families was simply not cost effective. And of course this was based on solar lighting, which apart from the initial capital cost, which can be very low, has no ongoing running costs. And I will show in course of the presentation that in fact the lower end of this kind of light source can be recovered in savings of not using candles within 6 to 8 months. But let us step back a little bit and talk a little more about business format franchising. A franchise has to start off with an existing successful business. You cannot franchise an idea. This is bordering on fraud. The existing company would have a number of options of expansion, and one of them would be branches, which means the company would have to put up the money for establishing branches all over the country or later all over the world. And it would also have to provide working capital, and it would have to rely on managers to operate the business for that. Now, if franchising is involved, the franchisor in theory, and I say in theory, I will explain in a moment why, is responsible for funding the operation. And because it's the franchisee's own money, the franchisee typically far more motivated to operate the business successfully than a manager. And this is really at the core of franchise success and why franchising is so successful, both in South Africa and worldwide. As I mentioned earlier, we have over 500 franchise rules in the country. The interesting thing about this aspect is that the vast majority of franchise brands in South Africa is locally grown, with a number of big guys like McDonald's and Kentucky. But the vast majority, I think it's 89% or thereabouts, of successful franchise operations is homegrown and very, very successful. Some of them, like Mandel, not only have started in South Africa with a new concept, but are also successful now in the UK, in Australia, and several other countries. So, South Africa is right up there with the best in the world on franchise practices. One problem we did have until a very short while ago, it has not been addressed, was that franchising was a free-for-all. The Franchise Association of South Africa, FASA, had a very good code of ethics. But only members of FASA were obliged to adhere to it. Anyone who chose not to be a member could basically do what they want. And this led to a number of really nasty failures and people lost their life savings and still owed money to the banks. But this has not been put to rest largely because the new Consumer Protection Act, for the first time in South African history, regulates franchising to quite a significant extent. Today, if someone wants to offer a franchise, the company has to offer a disclosure document which gives full information about the concept and its likely profitability and how statements made are arrived at, whether it's
your fiction of it is drawn from past performance of the own company. The French agreement is regulated. In other words, it has to contain certain minimum conditions. And one of the requirements is that the franchisor, who is entitled to income from three different sources, I will explain, provide value for money throughout the articulation of the relationship. The franchise agreement typically is entered into for 5 to 7 years, and normally has a clause, subject to performance, that the franchisee can extend the agreement by a similar period, and after that, it's already open to negotiation. Now, what the franchisor is expected to do, always has been expected to do, but now is legally obliged to provide. Number one is careful screening of franchises. In other words, the franchisor is not supposed to offer business opportunity to a prospective franchisee who clearly isn't able to provide, to sustain that opportunity and utilize it effectively. The franchisor is supposed to provide food training. The Consumer Protection Act specifically states that the franchisee must receive an operations manual, which is an agency guideline of how to operate the business. It covers everything in business from opening the doors in the morning, switching off the alarm, to operating the business, closing it up in the evening, how to hire staff, how to treat staff. And there was one concern expressed earlier today about by one of the members of parliament about companies not saying UIF, and I would imagine there's also concerns not paying taxes. Now, in a properly structured franchise operation, the franchisor is not responsible for that. But I have not come across any reputable franchise brand which doesn't oblige the franchisee to register a business formally, which means start the way the business exists, and then to adhere to all the regular requirements, which of course include paying taxes and paying URS and all that. There's not just goodwill, there's also a logical consideration. If a brand expands and goes around, that the staff is really badly in a business, the brand will suffer. And if the brand expands and goes around, that performance in one particular business, in other words, let's take a fast food outlet. If you do, and I'm not pointing fingers, I'm just using the brand because everyone knows it and loves it. If you go to a Wimpy outlet in Cape Town and get stomach problems, you will be reluctant to go to a Wimpy outlet in Joburg because remember, I got sick at Wimpy. So, franchisors have every incentive to control proper business performance of their franchisees. I've just covered franchise selection, I've just covered ongoing support, but I would like to speak a little bit more on this. Oh yeah, that's an important point to mention. In a properly structured franchise, the franchise will not make any money unless the franchisee is successful. Because the financial arrangements of the franchise are such that the franchisee on joining the network pays a relatively small upfront. The real incentive for the franchisor and franchise comes from two other aspects. The one is ongoing management services fee, which is a percentage normally between 5% and 7%, that's sort of the average, of the monthly turnover of the franchisee makes. And the other incentive for many franchisors is to sell products through a dedicated network. there has been competition law concerns in the past, but the Competition Commission has said in a statement to the Franchise Association, which is publicly available, that as long as there's economic benefit, there's no objection against franchise law forcing franchisees to purchase from the franchise law or a prescribed source of the franchise law. Forces was necessary to understand what I'm getting is in a moment that only other thing I would like to quickly dwell on is how does this work out from a cost angle for the franchisee. The franchisee pays a joining fee. The franchisee pays for the infrastructure investment, in other words, shop fitting and working capital. On the other hand, Eric, and of course the franchisee on an ongoing basis pays a percentage of its sales to the franchisor for ongoing support. So the franchisor initially selects the franchisee, trains the franchisee, assists the franchisee in setting up the business, and on an ongoing basis the franchisor provides ongoing support, which might be by purchasing, which might be joint advertising, which might be, or must be in fact, regular visits to the franchisee's outlet to make sure everything functions as it should, and to add troubleshooting services and ongoing training and so forth. As I briefly mentioned earlier, micro-franchising is all set, just in a smaller scale because of course the sums of money which are available on both sides are no more than limited. And
when I heard about the
fund idea, it occurred to me that a fund like the 100 million supplier development fund could solve six tangible problems South Africa faces at the moment at one strike. It could create sustainable businesses, it could create jobs, it obviously would involve skill transfer, it would help to improve the quality of life of people, and there are many of them, I was surprised, I picked up some statistics, who still rely on firewood for cooking purposes and rely on either kerosene or candles for lighting purposes. It can create a number of sustainable, relatively low-cost PPE opportunities, which addresses another concern raised earlier today. Believe it or not, it can impact on carbon emissions and improve the environment. It can also take pressure off Eskom. And last but not least, on the medium to long term, it could create manufacturing capacity, which would then lend itself to export initiatives. And the way authors would work, and I apologize for referring to Mark, Madam Chair, as I say, I didn't know when I was writing this thing that I wasn't supposed to do that. But let's say a large retail organization with 100 million to invest, if they would just take 10% of this money, and number one, set up a subsidiary or a PE company, which I named for ease of reference, I named it Solar in School. This company sets itself the target of, of importing initially solar panels and selling them to the existing store network, which we all know in this particular case is available. It then sets up a network of franchisees who are trained to install the solar panels, because you can't just buy a solar panel and put it outside. It has to be properly installed. Solar power can supply from one small light bulb do a complete installation for a house, including fridge and television and cell phone charging and so forth. It's done at the moment, it's rolled out at the moment in Botswana, and it's working very well. So what it would entail is having a franchisor company, testing the market, finding out what works, what doesn't work, setting up a franchise concept, and then offering this concept to people who want to start a small business installing solar panels. One way of doing this simply, I thought, was that the stores which sell the solar panels sell a voucher. The end user visits, the end user contacts the nearest installer and says, look, I want to have my solar panels installed. The installer does the job, gets the voucher signed, goes back to the company and says, I did my job, I want my money. In areas where the retailer doesn't have a footprint, the franchisee could sell the solar material. Now, this could start off with the solar panels. It could include solar lenses for people who can't afford solar panels. And it could ultimately expand into much larger installations. And it could also go into related products like solar powered radios, for example, which are very successful in some parts of Africa. The concept, obviously, once it's working, would have huge potential, because in Botswana, they work out that a village of 60 dwellings can support one franchise. The market potential in South Africa is enormous. We have something like 9 million dwellings. You could start at the lower end of the market. You could try and get support from people like Eskom, which is precisely what is doing Botswana. The Botswana Power Corporation is funding the capital infrastructure of the basic solar installation. The people are then responsible for monthly subsidies. And you could go to upmarket homes and sell some solar panels as a security device. If the power supply interruptions, the solar panels would still work. Obviously, this thing could be exported in two different ways. On the one hand, once the franchise is successful, you could export master licenses to other African states or even all over the world. Or you could set up silent franchises, if you wish. The second option would be, once the volumes are here, to start manufacturing solar panels locally, which is done at a limited scale, but the quality, I believe, is not very good. This could obviously be handled properly. And the solar panels itself would be a viable export item. And there's huge demand all over the world, including Australia. And even countries like the country I come from, which is Austria, which hasn't got 10% of the sunlight of South Africa, is using solar power. And it's subsidized on the food. So, my thought about funding the whole thing was to take 10% of the fund, like a 100 million fund, take some of the money out of the 10 million, and set up the franchisor operation. Save the rest of the money into a trust fund, administered by one or all of the banks, and every franchisee, in my opinion, would have to bring some money to the table, otherwise the thing is not going to be successful. But the balance of the fund, we've got to be realistic. The people we target won't have enough money to buy a bucket and buy a toolbox. The balance of the money could be advanced by a financial institution on the strength of the trust fund acting as surety. So as the franchisee repays the loan over 5 years, the trust fund gets unencumbered again, and can use the same money almost indefinitely to fund new franchises. And this is, in a nutshell, the concept I was thinking of. And there are a lot of references available. I for one would be very happy to assist anyone who wants to take this project further. If someone wants to know about franchising in South Africa, and I have a book which I'm very proud, I apologize to the chair. I can't stop thinking, but it will die in the sample. I compiled a book about 3 years ago, and it gives the history of franchising in South Africa, going back to 1955. There's another book which I only have contributed 2 chapters. It's published in the UK. I contributed 2 chapters. It's interesting because it gives case studies of micro franchise projects. All over Africa, South America, and Japan. And as I said, for some odd reason, also franchising is well established here. We have no worthwhile micro franchise project. Thirdly, would lend itself ideally to this because here's a secure market, a growing market, and the investment is money is probably less than 200,000. And this, in a nutshell, concludes what I wanted to say, Madam Chair. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much.
furniture may answer.
That's the only question. That's the renown.
Money is not a question as such, but I just see clarity. Unfortunately, your presentation is not paginated, and I cannot refer you to a page, but the heading is the business concept. At bullet number 3 and 4,
not maybe yours, but ours are not.
Three.
Not numbers. Fine.
What I want to get, I just want you to clarify that, because I can't find the difference. It says franchisees install and maintain installations in bullet number 3. Bullet number 4 says, if no must be paid, franchisees sell, install, and maintain. Can you just clarify that?
Okay, you want to respond? Yeah.
Okay, let's start with the monopoly aspect. I have to make a confession that it's yes. I'm an entrepreneur, I'm a at heart, I'm not actually an entrepreneur and investor, but I believe in the free enterprise system. And I believe genuinely that a monopoly like Mark Walmart has a problem. They cannot effectively access small outline sectors. I mean, we don't have to look far. If you look across the border to Botswana, the Botswana Power Corporation found it was not feasible for them to take power lines and maintain them into the little outlying villages which are all over Botswana. So their solution was to set up a network of franchisees, which are people who travel around either on a bicycle or on a motorbike, or at best in a bicycle, and install and maintain solar panels. Power Corporation could not do this cost effectively. There has to be somebody who lives in the vicinity. Because for them to send a vehicle from a Gaborone 600 kilometers to repair one broken fuse is not feasible. We can apply the same principle, I believe, to the Vietnamese. On the other hand of the scale, a small entrepreneur living in a small village can never hope to generate the volume he needs to buy solar panels in my particular instance. Here is what I have to store on, but we can use any product for this example. So if the large retailer is selling solar, he's purchasing solar panels in huge bulk, ultimately they have encouraging local manufacture. And then the local franchisee does the installation and does the ongoing maintenance. I believe it's a perfect marriage of the big companies and the small companies. And there's very little danger of the large company ultimately deciding, we push the little guy out of business and do it ourselves. Because for a large company to send someone into a village, it just gets too costly. If it's a local person who lives there, they have to send a manager to control it. If it's a person coming from the nearest larger town, you have travel expenses, you have accommodation, it just isn't cost effective, I believe. But the previous speaker said, this can work out to the benefit of both sides. Does this answer the first question? Okay, the second question very much brings into it. What I tried to explain, and obviously didn't do well, and I apologize for that. What I thought was, it is not feasible for a company like Mark
village behind the well. So what I thought, in the bigger town, the Mahatma stores came, Bilbao's warehouse, Macro, would sell the barrel, and the franchisee would do the installation. In the smaller village, the franchisee could keep a limited stock of product and could sell it and install it at the same time, and of course maintain it on an ongoing basis. Now either way, there would have to be some control over how this happens, and everybody gets his money and so forth. But I mean, just minor technicalities can be worked out. The principle, I believe, would be the benefit. And what I also tried to get across was that if the fund in part is turned into a trust fund, and I'm talking very small part, like maybe 5 or 7 million, and used as surety, not as direct funding, surety for a bank loan, then the thing would be indefinitely expendable because the money would come back, hopefully, and can be used again for someone else who is a business. And if the franchisee does well, he would initially have to employ at least one person because nobody can afford it to a bank on its own. It needs to be put on board and stand up and weather. But ultimately, the market employ for it. So you have small business creation and you have employment creation. And the big guy sells the stuff and makes a living, and the small guy facilitates the selling and installation and also makes a living. Am I answering?
Thank you very much, Mr. Sanchi. I guess they're still like selling a book there.
I'm not selling the book, I was opening it.
So you're not selling. What's happening?
No, I'm not selling it. If anyone is interested in the history of South Africa, I only got one copy here. I've made it to the first raised hand.
So they're not found anywhere else?
Well, it was in the bookshop 3 years ago.
So
but
no, no.
But yeah, I bought the last, say, 800 copies or something. I also put together with a man called Eric Parker, who is a franchise guru, and we jointly bought the balance of the book, 10,000 copies were printed. And
okay,
we have probably another 40 or 50 left. So I'm happy to send Mr. Cooper his permission. 10 copies if there's interest for it. I have 2 hands now.
Oh, so they're not sold, they're for free.
This book is for free.
Even other members here can ask us, can get that and you must be clever, Mr. Mama. Get the value of the book and display it. Please.
No, it's below 100 rand.
No, it doesn't matter. You know this was for the
sale. It's
a number of
100 rand. But I'm happy to send 10 copies of this book to Mr. Costa's office.
Okay.
For distribution, whoever wants it.
Okay.
But it is a book on the history of franchising.
Thank
it does
you
not tell much about franchising. This book, I don't have to give away. This book has to be purchased. But it's available on the internet. And
I also have a book on micro franchising.
May I offer it to you, Madam Chair?
Okay. I like this here because they also serve as education. He doesn't know the political position. He knows that as a committee on economic development. So he's given to the committee. The book is
I will send the exact title and all the details for the
Mr. I'm doing it for the benefit of people who are here who are not necessarily members of this committee and members of the parliament. The book is called Micro Franchising, How Social Entrepreneurs Are Building a New Road to Development. And it's edited by Nicholas Silver. Those who want to purchase it, it's only available through internet.
It is available through internet, yeah.
Okay, so that's the odd work we had to do today. we are not marketing anything, but it's just an opportunity we are giving to the UNESCO because he was here. But thank you very much, sir, for the presentation and for the education you provided to everybody here. Thank you very much.
It was my pleasure, Madam Chair. Thank you very much.
Okay. May we then proceed to the next presenter. The next presenter is from the Economic Justice Network, and that will be the input will be done by Mr. Vilagasi.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Honorable MPs and members of the public presented here. I'm Simon Vilagasi. I work for the organization called the Economic Justice Network of the Fellowship of Christian Councils in Southern Africa. So we are called EJM for FISA in short. We heard about this opportunity for the input from members of the public on this almost in a mass merger process. So we decided as an organization to take this as an issue that we would like to participate in as well. So we prepared our input that says what we would like the community to consider in dealing with this issue. I've like painted a picture of the organization, but for your interest, the EJN works with 12 National Council of Churches in Southern Africa Development Community or Southern Region. We work on issues of trade, debt and finance, food security and SADC advocacy. As an organization, we bring the voice of the Christian communities into issues of economy, and we advocate for justice for disadvantaged members of our society in all these countries. So here in South Africa, we work in partnership with the South African Council of Churches. So we've been following the development in the recent competition tribunal discussions of the merger of the South African Walmart and the United States-based Walmart enterprises. In this, we would like to express our concerns regarding this merger of the two entities. Our concerns are mainly in the following areas. First, on good procurement. Our work with communities in South Africa has attracted our attention to the plight of communities from areas where multinational corporations conduct their business. Our concerns relate to the degradation of the environment as a result of these companies' operations in areas occupied by or adjacent to communities, which is certainly in that due regard for their well-being or danger posed to their livelihoods by these actions. We therefore request, this committee to include as one of the conditions of the arrangement that the next entities meet necessary means to ensure that they conduct investigations of companies from which they procure goods and services. We urge the next companies to engage the communities from which they source goods, to know if the companies are not causing damage to the lives of people and the environment. We therefore urge both companies to make it a condition of the amateur that they do not buy goods and services from companies that are involved in the forced removal of communities from their land and the sources of livelihood, or in actions that cause the destruction thereof. Our second issue is the issue of environmentally clean products. Related to our above point or request, our work has alerted us to the danger of products that are manufactured through processes that destroy the environment. We urge the emerging companies to place high importance to checking if the products they buy for their businesses are not made from environmentally degrading ingredients. So maybe if I can just relate this to agricultural products, we know that there are other farmers that use heavy chemicals like in their fields where they plant crops. So these companies need to check if that practice can be avoided, because those chemicals will destroy the environment. So, and these products may range from raw minerals that are extracted from the earth without due care taken to replace them. So we ask the companies to avoid sourcing products that lead to deforestation, pollution of water, air, and the environment in general. In instances where this is not avoidable, we urge the emerging companies to ensure that manufacturers of these products have measures to rehabilitate the environment that are degraded because of their manufacturing processes. Then I'll go to our concern, which relates to the support to small and independent producers. Our work in communities and with independent producers uncovered the challenge that independent producers like small-scale farmers, informal traders, community producers, and others face in their attempts to grow their businesses. Unfair competition from big enterprises makes it difficult for independent producers to grow their businesses. I think it has been indicated here that businesses in townships, they tend to suffer when big companies do activities that make it difficult for them to be in businesses. So we therefore say unfair competition from big enterprises makes it difficult for independent producers to grow their businesses. And we urge the emerging companies to support independent producers by buying products and goods from them. If this means that independent producers' businesses need to meet the health and quality standards of emerging companies for them to qualify as suppliers, we encourage the two companies to develop means of supporting these enterprises with the resources and skills so that they can improve the quality and health standards of their products. So in the previous presentation, it was indicated the issue about the first quotes that are made by community members and also other foodstuffs that people sell. So we advise the two companies to work in partnership with small and independent producers to find ways of addressing the challenges they face in their businesses. This will make it possible for independent producers to meet the standards that are set by the two entities in terms of production of goods. Another point we would like to raise to the committee is the point of the sourcing of locally produced goods. As part of our work on trade, we have witnessed the destruction of local industries by cheap goods that are sourced from China and from highly subsidized European farmers. These goods do not assist in the generation of revenue of countries where they are sold. They destroy the economies of countries where they are sold due to an unfair advantage that they are sold at cheaper prices than locally produced goods. The influx of cheap clothing and garments from China and other Asian countries has eradicated local clothing for producing firms and businesses in South Africa, and also this has been happening in other countries of Africa as well. So we therefore urge both Walmart and Massmart to desist from a temptation of flooding their stores with cheap goods from China and highly subsidized some products from the European Union countries. We urge the companies to make all necessary means to source goods from local producers and factories. And I think the issue of this 100 million rand fund that has been mentioned, it can be a good tool to assist in promoting local producers and factories. So we say these companies need to check the certificate of origin of goods that are assembled in South Africa, since some of the goods are sometimes 90% manufactured outside of this country, and only a small aspect of their production is done in South Africa. So what is happening, you find that maybe a company from Pakistan will set up a factory in another country, but they will just put one aspect of the product, and then they will claim that the product has been manufactured in that country, whereas it has been manufactured somewhere else, and it comes as a cheap good to the country where it is going to be sold. So the issue of the state of origin is very important. And we urge the emerging entities to work with local associations of producers so as to be able to buy goods that are locally produced. So we have associations like in the clothing sector that these companies can work with so that they won't buy goods from companies that are not certified to conduct business. And then another issue is the issue of respect for human and workers' rights. Let me say, South Africa is faced with a challenge of militarization of human and workers' rights by employers in factories and agriculture sector. The working conditions to which the workers are subjected by their employers violate their human rights. This includes employers that exploit workers from other countries outside of South Africa. There are employers that restrict their workers from accessing their rights by intimidating them with threats of dismissal from their jobs. Like when people want to join trade unions of their choice, they find that the employer will threaten them with dismissal for joining unions. So we feel that this is a worst form of modern day slavery, and it should be stopped from happening in a modern day South Africa. As a Christian faith organization, we ask emerging companies to undertake an assessment of compliance with best practices in terms of human and workers' rights by owners of companies they deal with. So this should provide these companies with muscles to deal with those employers that exploit their workers. So this should include checking if companies enable their employees to exercise their constitutional rights of membership to trade unions and of having their basic conditions of employment rights respected by their employers. We request both companies to work with organized labor movements to obtain information on employers that make it difficult for their workers to exercise their human and workers' rights. So in this instance, we support the contributions or the submissions of organized labor that they have made in this process. In conclusion, I would like to alert the committee that this document explains about our concerns regarding the matter between Walmart and Massmart enterprises. We believe that as much as both enterprises are privately owned, they have a role to play in the realization of economic and social rights of ordinary South Africans. We don't like a situation whereby we just give a blank check support to this merger as churches or maybe also as communities. We should not just say, okay, you can merge and do whatever you like. So the merger must take, must make a contribution to the improvement of the quality of life for all South African people. Instead, it should not exacerbate the present problems that our people have been struggling with before the matter is formalized. It should rather be an opportunity for enforcing a culture of respect of people's rights by the business community that would be involved in the business of both companies. We are therefore advocating for this change from our understanding that the merger of both companies will create a big enterprise which will be a major player in the South African business and social sphere. I thank you.
Thank you very much. For the presentation. Maybe then we get questions of clarity and comments from you. Babu Mabasa, we have Gary Namu. Okay.
We've got two questions from myself. The first question is, I do not understand the last sentence. We are advocating for this change. That's about the whole sentence. And then my second question is, assuming that a huge monopoly company comes into South Africa and it creates, assuming again, 5,000 jobs, but it does so at the cost of the destruction of 15,000 jobs, would you say such a monopoly company should still be welcome?
The presenter has indicated that he would not be comfortable with Massmart or Walmart flooding their stores with highly subsidized agricultural products because they would be cheaper. Now, my question is, you see, my understanding is agriculture in any country is a backbone of that country, whose people produce food to sustain the nationals in that country. Is it not better than that, because South Africa is not actually subsidizing farmers? It should perhaps be pushing for South Africa to also play its role to subsidize farmers so that product, internal products that are produced here could also be cheap. And also, you have said that you have concerns with Walmart not smart measures, and you indicated that you would not be comfortable if they were to import, you know, chemicals that are polluting the environment. This is chemicals that are used in is funding like maybe fertilizers. Now, you are not sort of coming up with an alternative here. What is your take now in the production of agricultural products that farmers should use in place of what is indicated is dangerous to the environment? Thank you.
Thank you, Member. May I indicate that I'm not alone. It is my colleague, Manta Hadel, who's sitting there. I think he has said the question, so I would like to request for your permission, Madam Chair, if he can come and join our meeting so that he can assist in responding to the question. In relation to the first question, in terms of the change that we are advocating for, we are saying that here, I think the companies will be big players in South African business arena. So it means that we have an opportunity of using this measure so that we can even set standards for other companies that would like to come and do business in South Africa, because for so long now, companies have just been doing things their own way without us setting conditions that will avoid some of these problems that we are dealing with now. Maybe if I may just indicate that we are also, as an EJN, we are working on extractive industries where we are dealing with the impact of mining companies in communities. So you find that in the mining agreements or licenses that these companies have been getting, they've been kind of able to get away with a lot of destruction of the environment. And we do not kind of tie them to strict conditions that can make them avoid doing that. So I think what we are saying here is that this measure, we should use it to set an example or a precedent so that we make business to do what is good for the country and also for the people. So, and then in terms of the second question, that should we allow this big company to come and do business in South Africa with the hope that it's going to create jobs, but now in the process it might end up destroying many jobs. This is a difficult question because it's not easy just to block a company and say, don't come to South Africa because you're going to destroy jobs, because it will be like now, you are blocking them from doing business. But in our input, we indicated that we should look at this as an opportunity to grow even small businesses in communities, like independent producers. So maybe jobs can be created in other sectors, but that's what I think might happen. And let me also comment on the issue of flooding of their stores with highly subsidized agricultural products. This is a very tricky issue because we are in the process of land restitution or redistribution, whereby we are giving land to communities that did not have access to the land. So, and in a process, we are requesting those communities to make the land productive. So, but if on the other side, we are now the uncontrolled import of products from, say, the EU countries, whereby farmers or their livestock are highly subsidized. So it means that when, in the example of milk, when the milk reaches these stalls, the shelves of these stalls, milk from Europe, it will be much cheaper than the locally produced milk. And then we know that consumers, they vote with their prices, so they'll just buy milk that is imported from other European countries. And the local producers that we have spent so much money giving them access to them will find it difficult to cope with them. And this example will also be found in other sectors or in other products, in other agricultural products. Like, if I can make an example, our work with organizations outside of South Africa, like in Ghana, has revealed that in Ghana, they allowed the importation of chicken pieces from Europe. So, but when those chicken pieces became so cheap in Ghana, people just bought them and they did not buy chicken that was produced locally. So, as such, local chicken farmers suffered because they did not have customers. So we feel that this is the issue that we need to pay attention to, that it should not be just substituting local products with products that are imported from somewhere. Instead, we should buy local so that people can consume locally produced products. So this applies to agriculture and also other goods. And on the issue of chemicals that are being used in the production of agricultural products, as part of our work with other civil society organizations like the Surplus People's Project, which is here in Cape Town, we have found that there is a model of agricultural production that can be used which doesn't destroy the environment. This model is called ecological agriculture, or EA, which promotes farmers to be considerate of their increase in terms of how they produce food products. So there are farmers that are using this model even here in the Western Cape, and it is working. It's just that they need more support from the government because on their own, they are facing challenges. So this is an answer to some of the things that can, which are mass production that is being practiced by commercial farmers, which is just use these heavy chemicals that end up destroying our water resources. So we feel that we need to promote these companies to source some of the products from the farmers that are producing in an ecologically friendly manner, which can support their farms so that they can also grow and have access to the market. So I'll give over to my colleague, maybe he would like to add as well.
Madam Chair, I think there's not much I can add to what my colleague has said. Suffice to reiterate that our hope is that the merger will not open the floodgates for other big enterprises to enter into the South African market and leave the worker worse off. I think that is our biggest wish.
Your biggest fear, and wish. Okay, no, that's fine. Thank you very much.
my colleague seems to be satisfied. I can see there's no hand from the side. Thank you very much for the presentation. You want to say something? Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think another important thing that I would request the committee to consider is that if these companies come to South Africa, like Massmart and Walmart and other companies, if they come to South Africa, may you please just check that they don't use South Africa as a stepping stone for them to go to other Southern Africa or to other African countries. Because you find that once they're in South Africa, they will use the South African relations with other countries to go to those countries and do things which they know that they can't do here in South Africa. So I don't know how that can be done, because it means that we need to work with our other departments, like the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. So, but we know that sometimes that's what they do with companies. They just leave South Africa, and from there they'll go to other African countries and do worse things, because they know that their governments are not strong enough to monitor them.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay.
You wanted to say something? Or you doubt him?
Not a question of just commenting to the community behind me, that we have some good changes. So do they reconsider something and go to change, and also they will contribute from the 10% that is really about the change.
Okay, you have more followers coming to your churches. Thank you very much for the presentation and the response.
Thank you everyone for listening to our input.
We are now going to get a presentation from Freimantech Foundation. Before they come, can we allow just five minutes break, conference break.
You give me a signal when to say pardon. I don't have a watch of mine. So. Our submission, which you hopefully would have seen and hopefully have a chance to look at, is essentially what one might call consumer-centered. And it's quite fascinating how conspicuously few references are made to the rights or interests of consumers. It's all about the rights or interests of other parties, competitors, workers, small businesses, and so on. The preceding evidence did refer to how consumers vote with their rands, but interestingly to me, from the Economic Justice Project, almost disapprovingly, as if why do consumers just simply buy what they want to buy? And I think when it comes to competition policy, that's really what you as a portfolio committee and the government ought to have in mind. The purpose of competition policy is indeed to be concerned with the interests of consumers. Other government departments of agencies deal with other issues. It's their jobs to deal with job creation, local investment, small business promotion, whatever it might be. And the one opportunity that government has to care about consumers is with competition policy. And it's quite fascinating how in all of the hearings and all of the submissions and all of the newspaper coverage, media coverage, consumer interests are scarcely mentioned. And if so, glossed over, and when they are mentioned, all the mentioned disapprovingly, as if consumers really are highly reprehensible and irresponsible to buy what they want, to exercise choice about what mix they want between products and prices.
Now, on that, I just want to mention the famous South African economist, William Hatzker from Cape Town University. He's famed in the world of economics before he left South Africa in exile as he fled from harassment for being an anti-apartheid activist many years ago. We're talking about the 1940s and 50s. He coined the phrase, the famous phrase, consumer sovereignty. From that, one of his students, Raymond Ackerman, coined the phrase, the consumer is queen, and the consumer is always right. Ackerman has explained how, using the logic of Hatzky, set up the highly successful Pick and Pay group, which is relevant here because it is the single most threatened company in South Africa by the World Multinational Hearing. And Raymond Ackerman's son Garrett, now the chief executive, has said that it would have been most unfortunate, would be most unfortunate, were the merger to be blocked, to his credit and the statement of principle. Now, the point about Hutt saying the consumer is sovereign is that the consumer ought to be sovereign, that what government should do is minimally interfere with who makes offers to consumers and allows consumers to decide for themselves what they want to buy and at what price and on what terms. Interference with that consumer freedom should be very rare and under very special circumstances, and then probably not by the competition authorities. Other people should be concerned with that. Function, one of the papers we sent you by economist Stellenbosch points out that in the European Union, for example, one of the functions of competition policy is indeed to protect competition against the propensity of laws and regulations to inhibit competition. So, this is one of the very, very important functions our competition authority should be serving, is to keep the market competitive, which means keep the market free to entry, and keep the consumer in mind, the consumer centered. Then I want to point out the great confusion that seems to pervade a lot of the discourse on the issue. We're not here to discuss Massmart Walmart, and we have to discuss principles, which is what we recognize in our submission. We didn't go into the Massmart Walmart matter. And there's a great confusion about whether this is foreign competition or foreign investment. And I want to urge you as a committee to keep this in mind, that this is foreign investment. And all the discussion about foreign competition is misplaced. It's confusing two very different kinds of foreign activity. For example, imports of agricultural products subsidized by the European Union are foreign competition. Now, anyone in South Africa can buy or not buy those products. That's a matter of South African government foreign trade policy. You can't have one foreign trade policy for Massmart and another one for Pick and Pay and another one for a spaza shop and another one for a street vendor. You have a policy about imports, and that policy is a law of general application as required by the Constitution and universally applicable. Then the other thing in competition policy, which is easily forgotten in South Africa, is how tiny South Africa is. It always fascinates me. People talk about South Africa as if we were a serious global player. We're a little minnow. We're less than 0.5% of the world's GDP. And we have the world's big corporations in South Africa investing abroad, SAB, Anglo-American, whatever, or foreign companies investing here, Longroad, whatever, or Massmart. We should, Walmart, we should be thrilled that a tiny little economy like ours is taken seriously by big role players. And it seems like easily we become quite deluded about what a little mini economy we are, and we forget about that if we want to be internationally competitive, as the Competition Act and your department's policy says, then one of the things we certainly should be doing is being very, very reluctant about interfering with who does and doesn't invest here, or who from South Africa, for that matter, invests abroad. We should bend over backwards to try to be a global player and stop this myopic little look at ourselves as if we're some serious economy, tiny little economy, and to protect local businesses, big or small, is really making us internationally uncompetitive. And we need to watch out for that. So, then there's also a propensity in competition law, which your committee has what Parliament ought to be very concerned about, which is that competition policy has become a means for competitors to avoid competition, not to compete. In other words, what they do, instead of going out there and appealing to consumers with better products and services, they go to Pretoria and appeal to the Competition Commission and the Competition Tribunal to stop their competitors operating. In other words, it's the kind of policy that says compete but don't win. If you do win, we're going to go to the Competition Commission and have you punished for the fact that you compete successfully and efficiently. So our competition policy is a very serious risk of becoming anti-competition policy and being used as a weapon against competition and competitors rather than being used as a means of promoting competition. And then I want to move on to the two big arguments, and I'll close with these, that have tended to arise. The one is related to jobs and the one related to imports. And on both of these, there's some very fundamental economic principles. The first is the question of the seen and the unseen. What you hear a lot about is what you can see. A particular company, particular jobs being lost, a particular business going under because it can't compete or whatever it might be. But what you can't see, which is the real art of economics, is the art of the unseen, is what else you get instead. In other words, if a company is more efficient, becomes more competitive, increases its market share, lowers costs, it spends more money. That money itself goes into the economy in an unknown way. You can't know. We're not gods. So what happens is that money circulates through the economy. It creates jobs. No one knows in economic theory whether you get more or less jobs. Let's say, for example, we could use Walmart, Massmart, or any company that merges. Let's assume, for example, they lay off half their workers, just to give a nice round number. And they do, by doing that, they cut costs and they become more efficient and they provide consumers with better goods and services. What happens to those workers? Well, firstly, money, they say, is spent in the economy on something. Could be agricultural equipment, could be buildings. Nobody knows. Summer holidays, anything. And those jobs could be more than the jobs lost. There is no way in economic theory of knowing whether the jobs lost is more or less or more than the jobs gained. You can't know that. And everyone talks, I'm afraid, in this discourse as if there's a static state of affairs. The jobs lost are just lost. Without actually saying, but what are the gains we get from that? Which is more money, more wealth, more growth. Let me just make a very fundamental point there about jobs. The fear that jobs will be lost, quite important to understand this. Why do people think jobs might be lost? Why is this always raised when there's a merger? The answer is because people fear more efficiency. You think that the company, the merged company, will be able to do the same job with less people. In other words, the fear of job loss is actually a fear of efficiency. And if we want this economy to prosper and succeed and we want to create jobs, we need efficiency. We mustn't come out against it as if it's some kind of evil thing. And then, of course, there's a more serious issue, which is that jobs lost in one place are not actually lost. They're jobs gained somewhere else, and there may be more jobs. Workers are released, particularly skills, the economy, competitors can employ them, people in other sectors, and the money saved is spent on buying more goods, which are offered to consumers. The economy is a complex and dynamic phenomenon. It's not some static thing that you can take a flash photograph and say, jobs are lost here, that's the end of the matter. No. Jobs lost in place A means jobs gained in place B, and there may be more jobs. No economic theory enables us to tell whether there's a net gain or loss. It's not static. You mustn't look at one specific context, look at the big picture of the entire economy. And so what we have is, in this issue of jobs, firstly, it shouldn't actually be in competition policy. Job creation should be other policy, other departments, other agencies. Competition policy should be about competition and should be about efficiency and should be about serving consumers and should be a countervailing force against other policies and agencies and departments that are actually having policies that reduce competition. This is the opportunity for one government agency to say, we are for competition. and it shouldn't actually get itself diverted into considering issues that are really not its turf and not its speciality. Now let's discuss the impulse question. There's a tremendous mythology that arises about impulse, and it needs to be very clearly understood. You can only import something after you've exported something. In order to import, you have to be internationally competitive. The money with which you import is the money you earn by exporting. So if you have a policy that restricts imports, you actually have a policy that restricts exports, strangely enough. One economist put it very beautifully. He said that what happens with our wine industry is that they put a whole lot of boxes of wine on ships, and the ships disappear over the horizon, sailing eastwards into the Indian Ocean. And a few days later they return, and the wine has turned miraculously into motor vehicles and textiles. Nobody knows how. Bioconversion occurs miraculously at sea. That wine becomes carbs. Well, of course, the technology is called China or India. And so you don't, the only reason you have exports and the only reason you want foreign exchange, we don't as a country want foreign exchange. We don't want exports. That would be nuts. We don't want to send our things to others. What we want is imports. The reason we export is to import. That's the sole purpose of an export. And what's more, an import is possible only after you have competitively exported. So the one thing you must never do in your economic policy is restrict imports, because they are the reward for exporting competitively. That's what you do with what you earn by exporting. Now, Walmart itself, of course, or Massmart, or Pick and Pay, or Woolworths, or whatever, doesn't export. But someone else does. It's the agricultural industry, or the wine industry, or the people who make leather products, seats, or canned furniture, whatever it might be. And if you restrict imports, you are actually restricting the exporters. You're punishing exporters. In other words, what you're doing is you're rewarding local, uncompetitive, inefficient industries and penalizing local, competitive, efficient industries. So the competitive, efficient industries which can export competitively, they are the ones we should be rewarding by allowing them free to sell their foreign exchange that they earn for this country to the people who import. Those people then import in order to provide consumers with cheaper goods and services and more choices. So that the direct way to benefit consumers is, strangely enough, to export. And there is no such thing as just imports by themselves. Let's just repeat that, because it's very easily forgotten in the mythology that revolves around foreign trade. We don't, as South Africans, want foreign exchange. We don't, as South Africans, want exports. We want what we can spend the foreign exchange on, which is imports. And we want imports, which we get by exporting. And this is very easily forgotten. So let's just sum up. In this issue of competition policy, two things are happening. One is, the purpose of competition policy is becoming very muddled and confused. The Competition Commission, if I may say, and the Tribunal are making some very strange rulings, and I'm going to refer quickly to two. One is, in the Pioneer Foods case, I don't know how many of you actually read the report, but the report found them guilty in one report of charging more than competitors, the same as competitors, and less than competitors. Less than is called predatory pricing, the same is called collusive pricing, and more is called monopoly pricing. Now, I don't know what else you can charge, that's it. In other words, what they were guilty of is having prices and products and being successful. Many people assumed that what they were guilty of was selling bread for too much. No, that wasn't their crime. Their crime was selling bread for too little. It wasn't the consumer that was being looked after, but it's less competitive bread producers. And one thing we all know is that the you don't really have to worry about the bread industry. Everyone bakes bread. It's the easiest thing in the world to produce. The vast sector in which you have to worry about a monopoly. But what they were doing in this particular case was selling cheap bread, so that the Competition Commission actually interfered with the rights of poor consumers to cheap products. Then on eggs, if they were guilty of charging too much, if your mine happens to be an egg producer, Bartlett's. So I called and said, oh, I suppose you're very pleased with this because the small independent egg producers are going to be protected. And he said, no, on the contrary. What was happening is this was cooperation to help the small producers compete with the big producers by having joint buying and joint marketing and joint veterinary products and so on and so forth. So what the ruling actually did was protect the big so-called monopolies, that's a bad word, but the big producers against the small producers. The only way they could be competitive was to collaborate, and that's what they were stopped doing. And so it goes. Now, I'm going to tell you one last horror story, which I hope you do think is a horror story. Some of you might know about an organization called Children of Fire, with which I have a minor connection. It's the organization that deals with children who are victims of fires in shanty towns, who burn and get injured, and the fortunate ones who survive but are grotesquely disfigured. The Department of Minerals and Energy Affairs asked the industry to help the LPG industry, and I don't. This is a story which has not been denied when I've told it, so I don't know if it's definitely true. But I presented it to the Competition Commissioner at a meeting of the South African Chamber of Commerce and Industry, and they said they would look into it. But what happened is this. The department said, for safety, can the industry find a way of lowering prices? Industry operators got together, and they found that they have joint distribution depots, they all have the same fittings, they do all sorts of things collaboratively, they can maybe lower the price of safe energy to poor communities by as much as 50%. The Competition Commission said that's illegal price collusion and stopped them. So what we've got here is a wild beast that's got out of hand. It is no longer clearly focused on its job, which is to protect consumers by allowing consumers to be sovereign and allowing consumers to make decisions and not interfering with those who want to supply consumers with more competitive, bigger choices, lower prices, whether or not they're imported and regardless of job implications. Those are a responsibility of other government policies and agencies. This Competition Commission has this amorphous weasel thing. It can do anything. Public interest. Nobody knows what that means. It means anything and everything and nothing. It would be much better if you as a committee and you as a parliament and you as a department and got hold of this law and got to the point where we have a law that has one purpose and one purpose only, which is protection, competition and consumers. Let other agencies deal with other issues. But even to the extent that we look at these other issues, there's very dangerous pathology there. That we want imports as much as possible. The only reason we want to export is to maximize imports. The best off countries in the world are the ones that maximize imports, not minimize. Imports are not bad, they're good. They need microphones, cell phones, the glasses you're wearing. These are imports. We want these things. And we get them only by allowing our internationally competitive companies to export and sell through the financial system what they earn to companies like Massmart and Walmart. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lowe. We're not in South Africa, we're not living in South Africa. We really don't know what Pioneer did. Competition Commission did Pioneer on. And I think you are someone else where we are not. Because my understanding is that it was the Relations Commission. So if you say that the society I don't think it's correct. I don't think it's good if we try to lead you to confuse our people. Because if you go to the location today and say what you've just said, that the bread price is not an issue, bread is cheaper, I don't think you'll come alive, you come out of the location alive. But everybody knows it's very expensive to buy local bread in South Africa. And it's not everybody who can eat. I was just making those comments because I'm representing people, and I think where I come from, many people were complaining. Actually, they were bitter that the competition authorities were not really taking the right position here because they're just. So we're just fighting and not taking any other action. So I think that they're calling for more power for competition authority. And what I'm hearing you saying today, it just makes me think that perhaps you're from somewhere else. Well, there are many issues that you're raising. It's your opinion, we appreciate that. But I think really, we should talk issues. When we talk issues affecting our people, we must be mindful of how we say them, for sure. It's very, very important. But anyway, thank you very much for the presentation. I will then hand over to my colleague in the committee to ask questions in relation to what you have presented to them. I'm noting Mr. Mare, Itate Rinamo, Babu Mabasa, Babu Mkiki.
Do I get a chance to respond to your comment?
Yeah.
Okay, Stephen, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Just the one thing that customers will always be a customer experience in a situation. And obviously that then if that's a free will to buy whatever they want and what they want. But often we are confronted by we are often confronted by inferior quality of products that often are offered to consumers. And I just want to refer to the old chicken salsa. The day was very unhealthy, I don't know. But there was an uproar on the possible negative effects of products. So that is the first one. Then the second one I want you to respond is, and this is hypothetical probably. If a company established in South Africa or decides to use South Africa as a springboard, so-called springboard into Africa, is that negative towards our economy? How will that create competitiveness? How would that create efficiency? How would that influence consumer choices and growth of the economy? Madam Chair, I thought of the third one which struck my mind. Indulgence, if I can put that one back in the next one.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Miller. Can we get to that different number? You will be getting an opportunity before I hand over to Mr. Lopez. Is that the number?
Thank you, Chairperson. Pick and Pay Hyper used to produce and sell a loaf of bread bigger than the normal size, but at the same time, a small loaf you could get from other stores. And later, that size of bread disappeared from their shelves. I actually asked them why, and they said, look, the government said it was illegal, and they stopped us. Now my question is, because this was good for the consumer. Why would then the government stop them? Because CNP was not saying we are losing by selling a bigger loaf at the same time. But the government intervened and said stop it. Why? Thank you.
Yes, because we are member of parliament, we have asked to the government, and you could have asked the government, why are you stopping, I mean, as you can say, from spreading, but I don't know whether Mr. Law will have that response, but it's fine. And the member two.
Thanks for the chair. Oh, no, thanks for the input. I want to assume that given the very, very proponents of the majesty agree that markets are not perfect, and as a result of them not being perfect, it is sometimes necessary for the government and other old players to adjust so that the fair defense are not felt, you know, to the bone. And then the second thing is that some of the European proponents are subsidizing agricultural products. Agricultural products, such that developing countries like Africa find it difficult to export to EG, the European Union. And then the third point is that there once was a 1950 economic depression worldwide. But if I know the way you assume the world to be perfect, if I was to follow the way you describe this perfect world where people are disappearing, we would not even have had the 1950 depression that the world has now. So I will invite your comment, and also to say, in South Africa, we had apartheid for a very long time, which has resulted in disparities that are geographic as well as racial. So, would you say we should just leave everything to the market in South Africa, and the market will correct everything that is a result of a bad economy of the apartheid state? Thanks.
Development candidate.
Number two, if you say you can't count just laws and things, what are you saying about the recession we have had? Can you come out with this thing and say, okay, not so much, and then I want to check, that's why when you say you can't find, you can't count the number of clauses and the number of things, I want to check the reflection. Well, what can you say? Do you think it's wise for the government to increase or decrease the tariffs so that we protect our employment, so that we keep our situation? Must be checked. If I can check with you, if you believe in that what can you say about the communities who organize boycotts of some of the products? Let's say
then we have a lot of motors have a certain number of things that we used to use in the ancient days, all the time, but developed to the extent that we are using the mode of transport that we are using now. And our intervention is not about, you know, things against development, but it's to protect the interest of the country. And our interest in South Africa is to, you know, embrace whoever comes into community development, like that must be to the benefit of the country. But if we have people who will come and not make a contribution in as far as the community development is concerned, I don't see any reason why those people should be embraced. And so we are listening to the previous presenters here, Mr. Kumfuti in particular, that he was saying, we are not against any investment in the country. Let us find ways and means to ensure that we are hand in hand and ensure that we benefit the country. Not the people to come and take from us and leave us where when they were not here. We are equipped, of course, but we have done a lot to advance to where we are today. And you must make sure. I'm sorry to wrap up here. And let me include the other, but we have a good go through the whole document that we need to input in 26 and notes. And the last line on page 3, the last paragraph, say additionally, Walmart must manage to have savings of profits in their properties to lay off workers. And those savings or profits will be flowed directly back into the African economy. If you can elaborate on that one, how are they going to flow back when people are laid off? Because we have people who have been laid off many years ago, and they never had the opportunity to get the next employment, precisely because of the lack of skills that you always talk about. We cannot assume that all people have skills, and we know that it is a day when people are retained. The cost of aid could also be a hindrance for you to get, you know, another job. And also what you get as you retire or as you get retired. Very often it's not enough for you to survive and be a business person. And that's why we have so many people who are trying, you know, means of survival. By, you know, selling something at the street corner, but those are survivalists. Who are living from hand to mouth and not have any, you know, a support for them to be better people in future, but we have those state-run enterprises, the farmer, the tuller, cooler, and the others who are trying to, you know, boost the economy. And we know that they play a role in putting the economy in the country and also contributing to job creation.
Thank you, ma'am. I'm looking at my time, and I'm glad to Mr. Maren, can I give you a hand?
Yes, thank you very much. Just the one point that I've got to ask you is that often there's a lot of sometimes assumptions that people use to make decisions either for or against. What in your view should be the way, maybe for us, to evaluate the success of mergers or not? Because I think a lot of, I mean, you have mentioned the word of one must assume. My colleague just before me has said that, you know, assumption. So, you know, we read and we hear a lot about the word assumption. To what extent does that influence our decision to either be for or against a specific transaction, maybe of this nature? Thank you very much. Or should one rather look at predetermined milestones, performance milestones? Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. May I then hand over to you, Mr. Long, for example?
Thank you. That's a lot. Goodness me, I think there are all something like 25 questions broken down, so I'll get through them as quickly as I can. Please, what I'll do is, with your permission, is I'll move quickly through them, but if those who ask the question aren't satisfied, please interrupt me and ask for explanation or elaboration. Otherwise, there's no way I can do justice to all of these questions.
Let's
start with yours, Madam Chair. I'm afraid it's not a case of matter of opinion, it's simply either fact that the ruling on bread against Pioneer was that their prices were too low and they were driving small independent competitors out of the market. That is what
they're losing the context. That's why I don't want
The context, what I'm saying is the context ought to be the interest of consumers.
And that was it.
Well, it's not clear how you serve the interest of consumers by forcing them to pay more for bread, which is what that ruling did. That's what it did. It said the bread is too cheap.
I think it's our responsibility to inform the consumers correctly, and I think they know what is right and what is wrong.
Yes, they do.
And I don't think that we appreciate the fact that you come to us after having dealt with those issues and having certified yourself as members of this particular committee, because competition commission is under our supervision or oversight. So we have done that, and we were satisfied, all parties were satisfied with the ruling that they have made. And in particular of this president, everybody was not satisfied with by the fact that there was nothing more. And when all those other issues were made later on, it was clear that everybody was concerned. So I think, Mr. Lowe, I wouldn't really agree with you to make more time of our decision when we think we are ready to, unless you want to tell us that you don't have any faith in our competition.
Madam Chair, I'm referring to the problem we have, which is that a ruling was made against low prices. That is effectively what was done.
Can I then request that you refrain from that because you are not informing the consumer correctly?
Okay.
Can you
then I will respond to the others as briefly as I can. Mr. Maria raised the question of inferior quality. That is a problem, Mr. Maria, if I may say, mainly for rich people. For poor people, they want low prices. And there's no such thing as a free lunch. High quality comes at a high price. So what you want in the economy is a full range of choices, high and low qualities, high and low prices, and a full range of outlets, small, big, street vendors, whatever. If I may say, also before I leave this issue, Madam Chair refers to the position in the townships. I probably spend more time in the townships than anyone else in this room right now. And we work very, very closely, permanently and intensively with UPCHIP, the Chamber of Orchid Informal Businesses, the Southern Orchid Association. Informal business is actually the thing we concern ourselves most with. Let me say that what we spend our lives doing is protecting informal businesses, the very ones you mentioned, Madam, from the grotesque, frankly, cruel, often interference by local governments all over the country that drive them off the streets with dogs and horses and police with batons. And so I would urge you to actually be concerned about the poor, be concerned about the people in the township, those are the starter owners, the informal traders. Here in the city, my organization was instrumental to a compromise, which was that yellow markers were placed on the sidewalks between which informal traders could operate. In places like Johannesburg, we have made no such success. On the contrary, the Johannesburg City Council has declared most of the city to be a so-called restricted area, and one of our big battles is to try to fight for the rights of the very poor, the unemployed, which I believe you're concerned about, and I would urge you to join us in that fight and to defend them against really sometimes extraordinarily cruel interference. Then you mentioned about what assumptions one can make. Well, I think the point is that you can't really make assumptions. What you should do is have principles. You should say the principles are objective rules, rules of the game, according to which competition policy is conducted, and one of them should be the interest of consumers. That should be principle. And another principle should be actual competition and not using the competition law as a means of curtailing competition, in other words, stopping other people competing with you, which is unfortunately happening. Sir, you mentioned the Pick and Pay bread issue in Hyde Park. I think I probably can throw some light on it. In the old days, there used to be actually a so-called government loaf, a regulated bread size. That's no longer the case. But what we do now have is a metrication law. And the metrication law says, specifies the sizes and quantities in which things may be sold. That actually is a problem because it reduces the potential for innovation and diversity of consumer choice. That's probably the law under which Pick and Pay was stopped from selling a bigger loaf than the prescribed metrication size. Then Mr. Mabuso mentioning markets are not perfect. Yes, of course they're not perfect, and there's no way to get them perfect. What you can do is have rules of the economic game that reduce the likelihood of imperfection. There will, of course, always be imperfection, and what you can, and that's really one of the important parts of competition policy, is to hope that competition itself maximizes efficiency. You did raise the 1930s depression, that was a somewhat different issue, caused in that case by what was happening in financial markets, the increase in the money supply, followed by monetary. A lot has been written in economics textbooks about it, but it actually was nothing relevant to what we're talking about here, which is so-called macroeconomics competition policy. Then, on the question of...
the next 1.5 minutes?
Okay, then, I mean, there are all of these issues that were raised. Obviously, I can't get to the one, what should we leave apart, the legacy of apartheid? Absolutely not. No, on the contrary, we are for much, with substantial interference to fix the legacy of apartheid. One is which to give away shares in all the Paris staples to black South Africans as compensation. Another very simple one is upgrade all the land. Black people occupy to full, unambiguous, tradable freehold. It's outrageous that black South Africans are still living under Goodrich land law in urban areas. And so that really, I mean, in any of these other issues, if I may say, in closing, all of you as members of Parliament get offered every year a book we publish along with 70 other institutes around the world called Economic Freedom of the World. You have all also been offered a book which we did for the ANC as a party called Habits of Highly Effective Countries. In those books, there's very, very clear evidence, not subject to informed debate, it's overwhelming now, so it's no longer even debatable anymore, that freer economies have fuller employment, higher growth, higher living standards, and the freer economies, the poor know that because those are the countries to which they migrate. They leave the less free economies, they go to the more free economies, and there all conditions are better, and it's very clear from that. If any of you don't have a copy, let us know and we'll supply you with a free copy. It has all the World Bank data, software in it with which you can do your own analysis of all of these issues, and the matter is really not debatable. Freer economies have more jobs, higher living standards, and in our South African circumstances, more equality. That's what the world's experience tells us. Thank you.
Sorry,
I'm out of time. I've not responded to about 15 questions because we ran out of time. I'm perfectly happy to do so. Is it germane to this? Yes. And also, I think Mr. Marais' question and others about the issue of what should government do. The answer is yes. In that index, Economic Freedom of the World, there's an index measuring the degree of economic freedom of different countries in the world and of all the countries are ranked. South Africa, since 1994, was rising up the index. In other words, our economy was getting freer, meaning we had less government interference. So it was getting less and less and less. Until about 2006, when we turned the corner and it started flattening and got slightly more. Which is very unfortunate because the world experience is that countries that are moving towards more economic freedom as we were after 1994. Prior to 1994, we were getting less and less and less, and our economy stagnated for 30 years in inflation-adjusted terms. After 1994, we suddenly started growing, and we need to get back on that path.
Can you ask the president to call the writing of what must be done?
very happy.
There are so many questions that you could not respond due to time, unfortunately. You are raising so many issues that sort of provoke a member, and we still have more questions. Perhaps we have to really invite you when we deal with maybe specific issues on competition law, on import and export policy issues, so that we can get those to raise a lot of interesting issues. We don't need export, we need import. What does that mean? We need to understand it in our context. To say there are many things that are not going right, that we feel the waste of time to deliver the market to correct itself and so forth. I think it's a very important there are many observations or assumptions that you make, but sort of would want to be probed further by members, and I think we must as a committee create some space where in a committee. But in terms of the questions asked today, because they are related to this particular measure, especially relating to economic growth, industrial development, more especially on job creation issues. So we want to respond to that.
With pleasure, Madam Chair. I do appear again because of there was some misunderstanding about whether or not these hearings were proceeding, and colleagues of Clu and Sound so have been asked also to appear again at 2 for the law review project, so I will be able to respond to some of them then. But that's about legal issues, and so we can maybe hijack some of those times to deal with these comments.
Yeah. Thank
you very much for the presentation and also for the contribution. Sure. But I think you understand that you want to take the path where Mr. Roach should respond to all the questions.
What I thought you meant was that if they are related to what you be saying, then you don't respond. But I will have to also indicate to him whether that he does not need to respond. But you must focus on what you will present him on later on. Thank you very much. Thank you, Mr. Lowe. We now have an opportunity to listen to the South African Youth Council, and that will be led by Mr. Earlier on, I was told that you are joined with, you are presenting a joint document between yourself, Black Fresh, and the NGO coalition. That's all. But you now only focus on the South African Council.
The final resolution that is not in kind of appointing the executive
of South Africa and the South African Council. Oh, okay. I wanted you to clarify that for our own record purposes. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, thank you very much. And, my name is Tulani Shaputa, as mentioned, representing the South African Youth Council with the blessings of Samoa. We do appreciate the initiative of the Portfolio Committee to hold this public hearing and grant us the opportunity to on this very, very important matter of the matter between Walmart and Massmart. And our interest on this matter is because of exactly the same area that your portfolio committee has invited people to come and provide on. It is our interest that we make sure that young people that we represent do find employment in the sector, and those that are already in the sector do remain employed. Also noting that the sector is known of absorbing numbers of young people that are still unskilled or semi-skilled. So we take it as part of our interest to make sure that those interests of young people are employed in the sector well taken care of. But over and above that, as young people, we have a legitimate claim to the future, and therefore the future ramifications of the matter that is under discussion would also affect us in future. So that is the interest that we have in this discussion. We premise our input by raising a concern on the oversight that has been given on the notorious global trade offers of Walmart, especially in the area of legal issues, the conditions under which wages work, the rate of low wages compared to other retailers, and the issues that are commonly known around the attitude of Walmart on unionization. But secondly, that global track record talks to issues of common practices that do not seek to promote the economic development agenda that our country has set a path for. And that concern also relates to issues of global trends that are well known about Walmart on the issues of their suppliers and the impact that their existence in different communities, markets, and economies have on the local suppliers. And the disregard that has been presented by many other stakeholders before us on the competition laws, the issues of employment that we have called out to discuss, and most importantly, local economic development issues. On issues of employment, our argument is that the measure is likely to bring about further loss of much-needed jobs within the MET entity. And that will not only be limited to the MET entity, but it will also have implications of job losses for their supplier base and also suppliers of their competitors and the entire retail sector. To this extent, there is sufficient evidence to suggest that Walmart kills 3 local jobs for every 2 they create and reduce the retail employment by an average of 2.7%. In 2005, the National Bureau of Economic Research, one of their researchers found that the average Walmart store reduces earnings per person by 5% in the country in which they establish and operate their businesses. And the perceived lowering of prices comes at a great cost to employees who are compelled to take lower wages and poor working conditions. So the discussion that the committee just had now about the perceived prices that would be introduced at a very, very low level, such that communities and the unemployed and those who are underemployed are able to afford those goods and services, is actually not coming as cheap as it is perceived. It is the workers that will have to bear the brunt of those low costs that they are counting. We also note that there is an express intention by Masmat to expand by establishment of grocery stores in rural areas. And our view is that that expansion is what is going to squeeze the existing small enterprises out of the market, and thereby leading into further job losses by those small enterprises that are already existing in the various communities, especially rural communities, that they will be targeting for their expansion. And in our future, the measure will be the site for escalation of sexualization, undermining of labor laws, and most seriously undermining the intent of the new program as a decent work country program. In terms of the local development imperative,
Our premise then here is that no economy thrives on foreign direct investment alone. There has to be certain internal and microeconomic imperatives that are met for FDI to thrive and support the growth and the thriving of any economy. With that in mind, we think that the introduction of Walmart into the South African market will reinforce the oligopolistic concentration of the sector into fewer owners. This will work against the national efforts of distributing ownership, control and wealth to our already unequal society. The measure will definitely trump local trade and retailers as a trend in communities and economies in which it already exists. And the adverse result of high imports that Walmart is already known of, even in the US where it originates, will certainly lead to casualization and displacement of workers, subjecting many households to chronic poverty. And that is an imperative that we can, a developmental imperative locally that we cannot compromise on. And we see, and if that is the case, we then see the measure contributing to turning South Africa into a nation of consumers rather than producers. And our view is that the proposed 100 million fund for the support.
I hope you were there when you were saying that some of the things after. Now, once we start talking about the proposed 100 million fund, then I think you are talking about the end. Can you avoid that?
I think that's a very good question. In terms of local manufacturing, Walmart is notorious of importing its supplies from cheap labor countries. And without a shred of doubt, the measure will compress other retailers, the demand for local products in their value chain and the downstream procurement opportunities. It will definitely lead to a significant foreclosure of domestic manufacturers and suppliers. And at the rate at which, or on the scale of the proposed incentive, local businesses will definitely not match the resources and the economic scale available to the potential foreign suppliers that are likely to be introduced in time to supply the matched incentive. And therefore, our argument here is that the introduction of the merged entity will introduce a dynamic where the existing local manufacturing and supplying companies will be squeezed because of their incapacity to connect the potential foreign companies that are likely to be supplying the merged entity. And we conclude our presentation with recommendations that we would like Parliament to consider. That one, Parliament should ensure inclusion of social justice in foreign direct investment agreements that come into the country. And those must include issues of job security, social security, and compliance with other local economic development imperatives as outlined in the new code part in ICAP 2 and other such strategies and the different work agenda. Secondly, that the foreign direct investment must be in line with the industrial development strategy and should be directed to new industries to stimulate growth, to create decent jobs and decent living standards for struggling households. We also want to recommend that Parliament should call for a long-term planning on how will the measure contribute to industrial development without importation of cheaper goods or multinational price transfers. We also want to suggest that Parliament should call for the development of a monitoring system that would calculate the multiplier effect and even the impact of the measure. And that Parliament must call for the inclusion of sectoral and closing into the new
home park is one of the priority sectors. And the parliament should call for the imposition of local content quotas in all the FDI deals that are introduced in the country so as to face jobs. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your contribution and for your input. And sorry for disturbing you or to remind about what I was saying. We thank you for that and would like to give the opportunity to the members for questions for clarity. Baba Polinamo, Mamikeli, Baba Maba, and that's what. Thank you.
Thank you, Chef.
FDYC. You said that Walmart is notorious of importing materials from cheap labor countries. Now, my question is, what is your harm here? Is it cheap labor that produces the goods or the goods themselves? Because I don't think South Africa can do anything to stop cheap labor in other countries. But I want to know your concern here, whether it's cheap labor itself or the goods that come from those countries.
Insurance funds, Intercate,
does that have an effect on their children and on that chain? When we say that effect on that family chain, and what is the effect?
Let us double number.
Thank you very much, Chair. The first question on whether the concern is on the sheep liver and on the goat itself is on both class. I'm saying it's on both class because if South Africa has certain laws, if the South African society has certain laws that it upholds, then it is up to the South African society to make sure that it keeps and promotes the spirit of those laws with whomever that it might be interacting with. And so we think that although South Africa might not do much about the labor laws and cheap labor that is experienced in many other countries, but where we can, we should not support transactions that would even perpetuate those in those countries. More than the issue being about the cheap labor in those countries, the economic factor is that the cheap labor in those countries will result in the companies that we're talking about positioning their pricing lower than the countries that uphold proper labor laws. And it means that their products and services, their goods and services, will be preferred in different parts of the world. And that on its own would also put pressure on the local industries that we can supply those goods and services. So it means that the preference will be on getting those cheaper goods because of the reduced labor costs from those cheap labor countries. With regard to the rural expansion, our view is that we do not think that this touted rural expansion will contribute to the rural development strategy that our country has. We do not think so because, one, when you take these grocery stores into the townships, into the villages and plants, you are killing all those small businesses that are already or currently operating in those areas. But secondly, you are not only killing them, you are also killing the entire value chain of supply and the downstream procurement opportunities that emanate from the goods and services or the supplies that those existing businesses buy. So in our view, it might seem that by taking this store to the village, we might be taking a store closer to people where the people will get these groceries cheaper. But in fact, that is not the case. It is killing those local businesses, and someone else will have to bear the brunt of the cheap price that is perceived on the face of the consumer out there. And unfortunately, the people who will have to bear that brunt are the workers in those jobs. And the brand that they will have to bear will then lead exactly to all the conditions that Umaguma was talking about in terms of the benefits that the workers have or do not have. And so definitely it does not make any contribution to the rural development. But instead, if we are to be serious about rural economic development, there are enterprises that have been there, and our support must go towards making sure that we support and strengthen townships or rural enterprise hubs. Because those are already in place. But our support must go to them to make sure that we cut off on the cost of transport for people to leave a village to get to the nearest town to buy, by supporting those township and village enterprise hubs. The programs that are put in place by government to support job creation and entrepreneurship for young people in our view, we see them as intervention, not interference. Because you are dealing with a group of people that if you do not make an intervention in their lives when they are still young people, you are likely to have a case of people. If you meet them when they are still in the bracket of youth, there will be a liability to the state welfare system later on in their life. So it is indeed an intervention, not an interference from our side. The rural and township businesses will not survive the introduction of the monopoly, whether through the proposed measure or the expansion plan. Some of the reasons we have already highlighted. Because one, the monopoly will have its preferred people that it buys from. But secondly, the monopoly will be coming into the market to suppress the local enterprises that were already doing that. But that suppression does not only affect that sector, which is the retail sector in this case. It also affects those sectors of the economy that supply the retail sector with its goods and services. So they will definitely not be able to survive that when the monopoly comes in. And the benefit that a workers do not have from these kinds of companies, the adverse effect is definitely felt by the family where those people come from. Because it is our view that for every person that works in a household, it is the responsibility of that person to make sure that there is electricity so that young people can learn under proper lighting. It is the responsibility of that person to make sure that they provide proper health care to those people. So the adverse effect of the non-provision of those benefits that you mentioned, Bob Maba, definitely affect young people in those many respects. And if it affects them in those many respects, that has implications for the future or the probabilities of those young people to excel in their lives. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much for those responses. Would like to thank you for coming and thank you for your input.